detrás de mi dovo imploro la faver.
La porte du palais n'est jamais défendue à de tels suppliants.
Thank you. Di Dio se no cerce l'Italia u le sar lui prometta crepa glorie il bonheur de Rodrosia in patrie
Il
Aeneas has arrived in Carthage and pledged that he and his men will fight alongside the Carthaginians to repel the invading army. That's how the third act of Berlioz's opera, The Trojans, ends. At the start of the fourth act, the invaders have been defeated. Dido and Aeneas are spending time together. They've gone out hunting, but a storm drives them to seek shelter.
Thank you. Thank you. Numeri te, prigo Thank you. Thank you. Italy.
After that stunningly beautiful love duet, Nuit d'ivresse et d'extase infinie, there's a sudden terrifying chill in the perfumed air of Queen Dido's garden in Carthage as we hear that threefold call for the second time this evening. And now the god Mercury himself appears in the moonlight and calls again three times the fateful word which decrees Aeneas' destiny. Italy, Italy, Italy. As those thunderous chords drove home, his fate is inescapable. in this live relay from the BBC Proms of a concert performance of the Royal Opera House's production by David McVicar of Berlioz's epic opera, The Trojans. Brian Heimel is Aeneas and Eva Maria Westbrook Dido. Narbal is Brindley Sherratt, Anna Hannah Hip, Ascanius Barbara Senator, and Iopas Jin Min Park, with the Royal Opera Chorus and the orchestra of the Royal Opera House. The performance is conducted by Antonio Papano. And we'll be returning for the final act in half an hour from now. Well, just in case you've been so steeped in the world of Trojan mythology as to miss it, in the epic feast of French grand opera that we've been going through this evening, I can tell you that across the channel, Bradley Wiggins did it, becoming the first British winner of the Tour de France with a lead of 3:21. Well, now our interval feature, in which Paul Allen, with a Latin, a Greek, and a Shakespeare scholar, reveals how Troy has influenced and continues to influence Western, and in particular British, culture in The Trojan Horse Has Bolted.
For a city and culture that was destroyed utterly some 3,000 years ago, Troy is surprisingly present in 2012. If you're lucky enough to be in work, you'll probably know what it is to work like a Trojan. Your boss may hector you from time to time. And that Trojan horse, which was Troy's downfall, now lends its name to a kind of infiltration of your computer. Well, the horse has bolted, and this is where it's bolted to, here at St Paul's Cathedral in the City of London. It's where, according to Geoffrey of Monmouth, writing in the 12th century, Brutus, a descendant of King Priam, came, conquered the giants who inhabited Albion, and renamed it Britain after himself. And here he built a temple to Diana, the goddess who'd guided him. And this was accepted as history, at least up to and including Holinshed, whose Anglo-Saxon Chronicle, published in 1577, was Shakespeare's main historical source. To try to unpick how this city in modern Turkey, which some later generations thought was purely mythical, came to occupy such a large site in Western culture, I've been talking to three academic experts. Carol Rutter is Professor of Shakespeare and Performance Studies at the University of Warwick. Llewellyn Morgan teaches classics at the University of Oxford. And Oliver Taplin is an Oxford academic with a special interest in Greek poetry. He began by telling me what Troy meant to Homer and the besieging Greeks.
Well, in the Iliad, Troy is above all a beautiful place that is going to be destroyed. I mean, the most important thing about it is its destruction hangs over the end of the poem. And the Trojans are not foreign, they're not alien, they're not barbarian, but they are people with the same language, the same gods, the same armour. They are as human, if you like, and as sympathetic. They've done one thing badly wrong, which is they shelter Paris. They shelter Paris, who is the man who abducted Helen. If only they just told him to march, then Troy would not be destroyed. But as it is, it has the wrath, the anger of Hera and other gods that determine that it will be destroyed.
And Llewellyn, to Virgil, what's Troy?
It's a foundation myth for the Romans, so it's where the Romans all come from. But it's also a place that has to suffer and be destroyed. It's the disaster from which the Romans will recover and found Rome. So it's a place for which Romans have great sympathy and indeed sort of find their origins. But it's also a place that has to have existed and then stopped existing so that Rome can rise to the greatness that it does achieve.
And Carol, to Shakespeare, it's something of a surprise to some people, perhaps, that Shakespeare was concerned about Troy.
Well, we need to remember, of course, that for the Elizabethans, the notion of the Troy Navant, that Brute, as he was known, moved on from the Aeneid and sailed to Cornwall and came up that way and then arrived in London and founded this great city. So they saw themselves as the new Trojans. So one of the things that's worth remembering, relating the Troy story to our own culture, is that when William Caxton set up the first printing press in London, right at the end of what Shakespeare is going to make, the War of the Roses, so the big war that divides houses and kills, slaughters royal families in England. When he sets up that printing press, the first book he prints is the history of Troy. But I think also for Shakespeare specifically, he came to it, I think, in Troilus and Cressida, also as a way of interrogating contemporary notions of war and militarism.
So there we have it, in a way. It's about a culture which is destroyed, but nonetheless has a major presence in our own culture, even today when we're so ignorant about everything. Oliver, tell me a little bit more about the character of Hector, because he turns up in later history and he enters the vernacular in a rather devastating way. People use the term hectoring for somebody who's being bossy, basically. But he's... In other forms, he's a peacemaker, is he not? I mean, he's the greatest warrior of the Trojans, but he's treated as a peacemaker or potential peacemaker all the way through to, you know, Giraudoux's 1935 play, which was actually about Hitler, when he and Odysseus sit down and think, actually, the world's not a bad place, let's leave it as it is rather than have this fight. And that notion gets perpetuated onwards. So what is Hector?
He is the man of honour. And when Andromache in the Iliad tries to persuade him not to go out and fight, he says, I've got to, you know, I've got to be at the front. And when he realises that he's going to have to confront Achilles, he says, better for me to die, be killed in, with honour, than to run away.
It's intriguing, though, that Hector is the only Trojan, apart from Paris, who is nice to Helen.
That is very striking. Almost, very nearly the last words of the Iliad. Within 2 or 3 minutes at the end of the poem, Helen laments Hector, and she says that the reason why, above all, it pains her is that he was the one who was nice to her.
Well, let's hear that that speech, which is in your dramatised translation of the Iliad. It's Helen speaking towards the very end of the Iliad about her loss when Hector's been killed.
Hector, closest to my heart of all my relations in Troy. Years have passed since Paris, my handsome husband, brought me here. Better had I died before I abandoned my homeland. Yet, through all these years, I've never heard a harsh word from you, no curse or condemnation. If someone else insulted me, one of my many in-laws, you would calm them with your words, your gentle-heartedness and your gentle way with words. And that is why I weep for you and for myself, in my isolation. You were the only one in the whole wide land of Troy who was kind and friendly to me. Everyone else shivers at the sight of me. Ugar tismoi et allos eni troier urei erpios udiphilos pantes de me pephricasin.
So if we could turn now to you, Llewellyn, and Virgil's take on Troy. How far was he actually inventing the myth? Was it a current myth that would have been, so to speak, believed by everybody, or does he make it up with this huge epic poem?
The Trojan myth is a current myth in Rome. There are lots of aristocrats in Rome who think they're descended from Trojans. It's actually a myth that's used by Romans when they're establishing relations with Greek cities. This building up of a kind of a heroic origin. But what happens in Rome in the first century BC is a sharpening of the myth, and particularly a sharpening of the myth in association with the person of Julius Caesar, who develops a particular heroic ancestry that relates him to Trojan origins, descent from Venus through Aeneas. Now, Virgil comes along and it's a kind of win-win situation for him, because on the one hand he wants to write a poem which is capable of being compared to the Homeric poems, so shares that heroic origin. On the other hand, he wants to write a poem which has got some relevance to the family of Julius Caesar and Augustus, the new emperor in particular. So almost unnoticed, we have Augustus being established in our minds as the predestined leader of Rome by virtue of these Trojan origin.
And his protagonist, of course, is Aeneas, who Hector being dead, I suppose, takes on some of Hector's qualities.
I mean, Hector appears in a very important moment, handing over responsibility to Aeneas. And that has to happen because Hector really is the embodiment of Troy. And for Aeneas to become the character who can kind of plausibly carry the traditions of Troy to a new place and refound them, he has to be handed the baton by Hector.
I've heard you read from it before, and you read it almost as if it's contemporary Italian. So I'd love to hear some now.
Sure. This is when Aeneas is escaping from Troy, and he's about to realise that he's lost his wife, Creusa, on the way. Iamque propinquabam portis, omnemque videbar eva sisse viam, subito cum creber ab auris visus ad esse pedum sonetus,
genid hor que per umbram prospiciens nat exclamat fugenata propinquant ardentis clipeos at quaere micantia cerno. I was now coming near the gates, and it seemed that our journey was nearly over and we'd escaped, when I suddenly thought I heard the sound of many marching feet, and my father, looking out through the darkness, cried, "Run, my son, run, they are coming this way. I can see the flames reflected on their shields and the bronze glinting."
And of course he carries his father, doesn't he, in the end. There's the model of filial piety. It's very strong indeed. Carol Rutter, moving on to around 1600, leaping over 1600 years. How does Troy come, if you like, into English reading?
They were schoolboy texts. And you went to the grammar school to learn Latin grammar so that you could become part of probably what we would think of now as the kind of the civil service, or to become a playwright and a job that did not, of course, yet exist when Shakespeare went to school properly. And he would have come to his Latin through easy texts, extracts first, but then through Ovid and the Metamorphoses. And then eventually would have picked up Virgil and the Aeneid. Now, the schoolboy would have come across that extraordinary moment when Hecuba, in the 13th book, who at that point is washing the dead body of her daughter, her last daughter, who's been sacrificed at the tomb of Achilles to allow those Greek ships to sail home. She's there by the seashore when, what does she experience? The child she thought was going to live, her little Polymnestor, washes up on the shore. So Hecuba's entire children, her teeming loins, as they're described in Shakespeare, she produces, what, 50 children, Oliver?
The prime has 50 children. She has 21 of them, I think.
Well, that they are now all dead. And so the visceral revenge that she takes is, I think, the first go at King Lear, because what she does is go into the eye sockets of the man who killed her child and takes out those eyes. And I think that they would have been profoundly impressed upon the imagination of the schoolboy who was reading these stories. Mm. And then, of course, they turn up in another person who's at university reading these stories. It's the, you know, it's Hamlet at Wittenberg, who hears somebody speak a speech and wants to hear that speech again.
And it gives him a text on which to base a lecture on overacting, of course.
Yes.
You know, what's Hecuba to him or he to Hecuba? But it suggests that his audience knows about the Trojan War. Can we turn to the story that is purely about the Trojans, Troilus and Cressida, because this brings in characters with whom we are familiar. Odysseus, now called Ulysses, certain others of the Greek heroes, using the term loosely, and attitudes to Helen in it in particular. Helen seems to me an amazingly ambiguous figure throughout her kind of cultural history.
Yes.
So that Christopher Marlowe, of course, in Faustus has her, was this the face that launched the thousand ships and burnt the topless towers of Ilium? Sweet Helen, make me immortal with a kiss. But then refers to a kiss sucking out his soul.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but it sort of conjures up that notion of women having a kind of power over men that men can't in some way fathom,
mm-hmm.
Which I think persists up into the present time. What are the attitudes to Helen in Troilus and Cressida?
What the Greeks do in this story is that they send a message to Troy that says, look, if you just let Helen go, we'll call it a day. And it's Hector who speaks first and speaks persuasively to let Helen go. Brother, she is not worth what she doth cost the holding. And Troilus picks him up and says, but what's aught but as tits valued? And Hector responds, but value dwells not in particular will. It holds his estimate and dignity as well wherein tis precious of itself as in the prizer. So she's not worth it. And at that point, Hector has the moral high ground. He has absolutely the argument to end the war, as so many times the men in power have the argument to end the war. And then what does he do? He capitulates. He says, it serves our honor And that word honour, I think, in this play, for so many women, comes to be just so much drivel, nonsense, spuriousness, and of course then gets attached back onto the woman. But it's in our honour to keep fighting, and so they do.
How many of these figures actually continue to exist in, if you like, our sort of mythic imaginations? Odysseus, you see, I think, is still a hero if you're an island Greek. And Helen live on in a way, don't they?
Yes, and sulking in his tent.
Achilles, yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. Who died because of his Achilles heel as well.
The siren song.
A Cassandra. We use that in politics today.
Yes.
She is the prophetess who's given the gift of prophecy by Apollo, because he fancies her, and then has it withdrawn in the sense that she's condemned never to be believed because she won't do what he wants. And Cassandra's become a great figure, and not least in becoming the pseudonym of one of the greatest newspaper columnists in British living memory, Cassandra of the Daily Mirror. A real name, William Connor, I think.
Hecuba will always live on, is because we will hear that name again and again and again every time the lad from Wittenberg speaks it and remembers Hecuba and asks us to remember Hecuba and requires us to remember that story that is loaded in that name.
Why should we weep for her?
Why should we weep for her?
Yeah.
Whereas Hector lives on as a term for lecturing people. I mean, thinking about that, he's one of the ways that Hector is a good leader is that he tells people what to do quite a lot. I mean, that's all that he does in Aeneid. But in the Iliad as well, he tells people what to do.
It's particularly Paris.
Yes, indeed.
He says, come on, Paris, you know, we're doing this for you.
Yeah, the big brother sort of mentioned. Yes. Sure, that must be where that comes from.
And I'm guessing that in the 19th century, in what was the Victorian era in this country, but obviously not in other countries, he suddenly becomes a sort of safe haven for people who are beginning to be a bit worried about the Greeks. Byron, with his fantastic romanticism about Greece, goes and fights in the Greek War of Independence and dies. And then the Greeks assume a government, and people start to realise that the Greeks aren't actually any more Homeric heroes in the way they were. Odysseus is devious, dodgy. They actually only ever had a collection of city-states which behaved extremely badly to each other, and are we really going to take those as a model for founding the British Empire or the French Empire? So the French start calling their children Hector, as indeed Bellius. And somehow we start to react away from the Greeks collectively as a Western culture and more towards the Trojans, it seems.
Well, interesting if Troy once again is useful for really not existing anymore. You know, Greece is existing again, and perhaps dangerous. But Troy obviously continues to mean something, but it doesn't actually exist in the world. That was certainly how it worked for the Romans, or certainly how it worked for Virgil, as a place that you could talk about, in a sense, in the safe knowledge that it no longer existed, that Rome had replaced it and Rome was going to do things in related ways, but different ways and new ways.
There's a very powerful twist on that towards the end of Euripides' play Trojan Women, where three or four times the Trojan women lament, and Hecuba laments, Troy exists no longer, not even the name of Troy will exist any longer. And of course, the name of Troy, every time they say it in that play, the name of Troy continues to exist. And what exists is not the physical city, it's the suffering. The suffering of the women of Troy somehow comes to stand for the suffering of women in war. Mm-hmm.
And to some extent, does that not last right through to, say, Harold Pinter's Mountain Language play about how things can't be named because they're not allowed to speak their own language, and it is a bunch of suffering women and a military force that refuses to understand them, refuses to acknowledge the existence of their own culture, and although Troy is absolutely not mentioned in Mountain Language, it seems to me to run through it.
Yes, I mean, of recent poets, I mean, the person who perhaps, because the Odyssey has been so much more used in modern times than the Iliad, but Michael Longley has made amazing use of the Iliad in his poetry. But this Alice Oswald poem that's still less than a year ago that it was published, the poem is indeed called Memorial. Every named person who is killed in the Iliad is memorialized. Many, many of them are given lives. They're given past lives, backstories that make each one of them an individual human.
So you come at last to Hector. I love these, particularly these lines where it says, "He who was so boastful and anxious, and used to nip home, deafened by weapons, to stand in full armour in the doorway, like a man rushing in, leaving his motorbike running." And what I like so much about that is it's not a purely gratuitous incongruity. It's not just an anachronism for the sake of anachronism, because the man who rushes in, leaving his motorbike running, has his motorbike helmet on. Mm-hmm. And in the great scene with the helmet in the Iliad, the child, the baby, cries because his father is still wearing his helmet and he has to take the helmet off and put it on the ground. So this apparent anachronism actually taps into the essence of Hector in the Iliad, the man who wears the helmet and yet also has the son who he embraces with Andromache, who smiles through her tears.
Oliver Taplin, thank you, and Carol Rutter and Llewellyn Morgan, thank you both. Let's end, though, with Seamus Heaney's play, The Curate Troy. This is a version of a play by Sophocles, Philoctetes. He's a celebrated archer whom the Greeks have marooned on the island of Lemnos because he has a foot wound that's festered and stinks unbearably. Now they've discovered they can't win the war without him, so pragmatic old Odysseus is sent to break down his pride and persuade him to rejoin the army. Philoctetes has the choice to nurse and cherish his sense of grievance or go to Troy and be cured. It's a play for Ireland, of course, and the peace process, and it makes Troy not a geographical location anymore, but a place of the mind and spirit. It's because it's been destroyed utterly that Troy can be a canvas for other poets and other ages. This is what Heaney writes. History says, "Don't hope on this side of the grave." But then, once in a lifetime, the longed-for tidal wave of justice can ride up, and hope and history rhyme.
Paul Allen presented The Trojan Horse Has Bolted, which was produced by Julian May. Welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall and this live performance at the BBC Proms of Berlioz's epic opera, The Trojans. We're hearing it in a concert performance of the recent staging at the Royal Opera House Covent Garden, in which Brian Heimel sings the title role and Eva Maria Westbrook is Dido, with the chorus and orchestra of the Royal Opera House conducted by Sir Antonio Papano. But I come backstage here at the Albert Hall to the end of the Bull Run, the famous tunnel through which the artists emerge onto the platform, where it's uncharacteristically quiet, I have to say. And with me is Peter Manning, the leader of the orchestra of Covent Garden, who's been working very hard tonight so far. Peter, what's it like to be lifted up out of the pit into the bright lights of the Albert Hall?
Well, I think a BBC experience at the Royal Albert Hall is something that the orchestra and the chorus and soloists look forward to hugely. It's a monumental event, it's a monumental national event. And to be part of that is absolutely sensational. And to be lifted out of the pit allows us to really see the totality of the whole of the production, you know, in one space. Because, of course, we can appreciate when we're in the pit what's going on in terms of scenery. We can appreciate the players, if you like, coming on and off, the offstage trumpets and brass. We can appreciate the offstage chorus. But somehow we just appreciate that they're all there. So this massive amount of energy in all levels is in one place at one time in the Royal Albert Hall, and that's pretty terrific.
But a lot of things must change. I mean, you must hear each other differently, for instance.
Well, of course, the spread of sound in the Royal Albert Hall, I mean, one has to understand how that works, and of course we know that. So, you know, we're putting together a soundscape, if you like, which is about this hall, and of course it's a wonderful broadcast experience, so we're very thrilled about that. I mean, there's a special energy which comes from being in the Royal Albert Hall and to be close to one's colleagues in a different form of proximity.
Peter Manning, thank you very much indeed. Well, the original spectacular production at the Royal Opera House was directed by another new musical knight, Sir David McVicar. When I spoke to him the other day, we talked about just how much of himself Berlioz invested in the Trojans.
It is an incredibly and deeply personal piece. It's very hard not to love the music without also beginning to love the personality that lies behind it, and without feeling incredible sympathy for this Herculean mission that he set himself, knowing probably that in the end he wouldn't see everything on the stage, but his demon forced him to write this. And it was the culmination not only of all of his work as a musician, but the source, the inspiration, went back to his boyhood, the happiest times of his life. The gestation period was a lifetime before he felt that he could bring these heroes, these demigods, as he liked to call them, of his childhood imagination fully to life. And it's certainly heartrending that he only saw the second half of his score, and even then only partially, with the myriad cuts and with reduced orchestrations, reduced banda.
And apparently, as it played, they would cut virtually night
by
night.
They would play as, you know, there was, at one point mid-run, they lost the song of Elas at the beginning of the fifth act, simply because the tenor singing that role was no longer engaged by the Théâtre Lyrique, so instead of replacing him, they just cut the music. I think it's received knowledge now that it doesn't need to be cut, that we just need to listen to it, thinking about dramatic music on a different kind of time scale. Structurally, Troyen is absolutely pragmatically aimed at the Paris Opera, despite all the misgivings that Berlioz had about that institution at the time. He was, as a practical person, aware that only the Paris Opera really had the resources to put this thing on. So it's structured, its enormous five-act structure. The length of the ballet sequences is unprecedented, which even now many people find disconcerting, that suddenly narrative is told in pantomime and ballet, which is very audacious and very far ahead of its time.
One of the fascinating things about the piece is Berlioz is completely steeped in his Virgil, but he creates virtually the character of Cassandra.
That's one of the huge intuitive leaps of genius that he made when he was adapting the chapters of Virgil that he did adapt. But from his reading of Shakespeare, I think he learned a great deal, and he does elevate Virgil's Cassandra into a truly Shakespearean heroine.
You've mentioned Shakespeare. That was Berlioz's other great dramatic passion.
Yes.
And in this production, you become tremendously conscious that, particularly in moments like the big love scene, there's a fabulous, radiant humanity about it.
Yes, there is. And it's also, it's a self-consciously retro feel about what he's doing. There's a turning his back on everything that was contemporary in his time. He's looking backwards to a different way of telling stories. And in that sense, it's more modern to us than the sight of Santa and the Dutchman flying up to heaven in the apotheosis. You know, there's a kind of bleak honesty about his depiction of these characters. For me, it's, having done lots of Wagner, it's very interesting that there is no question of redemption, of making spiritual sense of these people's lives. They simply live, love, and die, and are trampled beneath the wheels of destiny, which actually is the reality of our lives.
Sir David McVicar, who directed the Royal Opera House's production of Berlioz's opera The Trojans, which we're hearing in a concert performance tonight at the BBC Proms. Well, the last act of Berlioz's great opera begins in the harbour of Carthage at night. Hylas, a homesick young sailor, sung by Ed Lyon, wonders if he'll ever sit in the cool shade of the trees of home again, and finally he falls asleep. Panthus confers with the other Trojan leaders. They can't delay their departure for Italy any longer. There are daily portents that the gods are angry. He says they've heard the voices of the dead crying out. And indeed, out of the darkness, we hear again the cries of Italy. The Trojans agree they must be ready to leave on tomorrow's tide. Then we hear an exchange between two veteran Trojan soldiers. They're very happy here in Carthage. The women here know how to look after their men. They want to stay on. Aeneas alone is torn by love and remorse. He must see Dido one last time. The ghosts of dead Trojan heroes appear, and Cassandra with them. They urge him to be gone. He mustn't delay even a day longer. He can't resist their commands. He must give up Dido. Aeneas rouses the Trojan camp and tells them they'll set sail before dawn. But now he has Dido to confront him. She's distraught, but however desperate her pleading, however bitter her curses, nothing can change his mind. His last word is Italy. Well, I asked Brian Heimel, who sings the role, what's going through Aeneas' mind as he struggles with this terrible dilemma.
In the aria, he says, I'm going to leave, but I can't leave without telling her goodbye. No, I'm going to tell her at least goodbye. And as soon as he's made that decision, the ghosts come and say, you can't wait any longer, not even 1 second longer. You have to go now. And so in that moment, he's on stage all by himself. He says, fine, I have no choice but to obey these orders and sacrifice Didon. when he falls in love with Didon, this is not part of his plan. He was coming in here for shelter, and then he fell in love with her. But I think this idea and sense of duty, that's the undercurrent that's pushing it forward and pushing him forward, you know, to sacrifice oneself for a greater cause. And I think that that's just what he has to do.
Brian Heimel singing the role of Aeneas tonight. Even as the Trojan fleet sets sail, Dido asks her sister Anna to go and beg Aeneas to stay just a few days more. But Iopas brings word that the ships have already left the harbour and are almost out of sight. Now all that's left to Dido is the bitterest and blackest despair. She'll turn to the gods of Hades. They'll assuage her torments. She should have foreseen his treachery and burned his fleet, she says. It's too late for that, but she gives orders for a great pyre to be built. She'll burn everything that reminds her of Aeneas. In the final scene, we can see the great heap of his gifts piled up, ready for the flames. Nabal and Anna pronounce a curse on Aeneas's landing in Italy. Let him find an inglorious death. Dido now climbs up on the pyre. She invokes Pluto, the god of the underworld. She foresees that one day a glorious avenger will arise from her ashes. His name will be Hannibal. She takes Aeneas's sword, and to the horror of her followers, she kills herself. Well, Peter Manning and his colleagues, as I said, about 100 orchestral players, and that massive chorus are once again assembled in their places for the final assault. And as you can tell, for the last time this evening, Antonio Pappano comes onto the stage here in the Royal Albert Hall. Just listen to those cheers for the marvellous playing of this orchestra to conduct the final act of the Trojans by Berlioz, which begins with that homesick sailor's song.
fare tu. Il fo partir on fa. I on fa, fate fec desespoir, lo quasse de la rene, la gloire le devoir, sono brise sa scene, I son cœur sera fort, o mo des adieux.
Passa a notre prima. Arrosente, je l'eau de mes larmes brillantes. Sagem non so chi doc ta fe sortir. J'obéis, sacres inexorables, je suis barbare grand, l'honneur est grand Dieu, et j'y parle divin, en détournant les yeux. Et vous croyez, aimez-vous, alerte, le point mort, la mer nous est ouverte.
Oh, my God.
Je vous aime.